Leslie Anthony writes, "The world of plants, insects, and pollination is one of the most intimate and exquisite manifestations of coevolution, something that has defined the biosphere of our planet and the existence of virtually all terrestrial life, most clearly ourselves. Now, it's a life or death process whose inherent vulnerability to interference should concern us. Stopping for a second to watch this miracle of natural selection up close has many effects on the psyche, all of them positive. Welcome to the Blue Hour. I am Farha Guerrero. Tonight I speak with Leslie Anthony, a Whistler-based writer, editor, adventurer, and science journalist and biologist. But first, let's start the hour with a favorite song of his titled Hello in There by the late musician John Prine.
Talk much more. She sits and stares through the back door screen, and all the news just repeats itself like some forgotten dream that we've both seen. Someday I'll go and call up Rudy. Together at the factory, what could I say if he asked what's new? Nothing what's with you, nothing much to do. You know that old trees just grow stronger, and old rivers grow wilder. Just grow lonesome, waiting for someone to say hello in there.
John Prine was one of the first well-known musicians to die of COVID-19 last year. Why is his music special to you?
Well, you know, he's a folk artist who you know a lot of his songs, but you don't know they're his. You know, he's very prolific, and there were a lot of songs I heard when I was younger that I thought, oh, that's a good song. And then later I'd find out, oh, John Prine wrote that, and other people had sang it, like, you know, John Denver, for instance, or some other folk artist. So after a while, you know, there was a critical mass that sort of developed in my mind of, oh, wow, there's a lot of good songs out there that I have appreciated over the years, and they're all John Prine songs, and I didn't know I was a John Prine fan. He was kind of in the weeds, under the radar sort of thing. I was a bit late to the party, let's put it that way. Anyway, I always did appreciate him, and he sort of resurfaced a few years ago. I saw him in a live broadcast from George Strobelopoulos's house in Toronto. I was like, oh my God, John Prine's still around. I had heard he'd had health problems and this, that, and the other thing, and wasn't sure. So, you know, I was aware of him, and I thought about him, and I went down a few YouTube rabbit holes, you know, listening to his music, and then was devastated in April, I believe, to hear that he, you know, was on a ventilator, severely ill with COVID, and then died a few days later. So, you know, I think it was one of those sort of things that made me really feel how real the pandemic was. It was cutting down, you know, mm-hmm. public people, and not just people who, you know, that people knew privately and their families and stuff. And I didn't know anyone who was affected. And so it might sound glib to say, oh yeah, you know, I knew this celebrity who died, but when you don't have another connection to it, it kind of, mm-hmm. it's your only reality, I suppose.
And COVID has been a difficult journey for all of us, and we share a new common struggle with the entire humanity. How has the pandemic affected you personally, and what reflections has it given you?
Well, it hasn't, other than the travel restriction, because I was doing a great deal of travel-based writing. Other than that, it hasn't affected my life so much. I'm a writer. I tend to work at home. I just had the opportunity to do more of that. I'm extremely lucky to live in a place like Whistler where I can get outside and get, you know, into a place where I'm not surrounded by people. And I feel like it wasn't that hard to navigate, to just put my head down and my nose to the grindstone and try and be safe, keep the people around me safe, and wait it out. However, having written about zoonotic diseases that jump from animals to humans, and other issues around biodiversity loss and invasive species, I was hyper aware of what this pandemic represented in a biological sense, which was essentially our cavalier attitude to nature and the environment finally catching up with us. And there had been many near misses, you know, leading up to this, where we had epidemics that almost became pandemics, but not quite. And it was eventually going to happen, and it did. So I suppose part of me was thinking, well, I knew this was coming. Here we go. I didn't think it would happen in my lifetime, but I guess I'm going to see how it plays out. And we will continue to carry more and to loose more things from their original environments, because we're destroying those environments, creating the conditions within which organisms or pre-organisms, let's say like viruses, can make the jump from the reservoir in which they originated or in which they typically dwell to another realm completely. And we've seen this happen with before this COVID-19 pandemic caused by SARS-CoV-2 virus. We had SARS-CoV-1 in 2003. We had MERS in 2010 or something. We've seen this happen several times with Ebola. We've seen this happen with AIDS. All of these, or sorry, HIV, AIDS is the disease. All of these being viruses that had dwelt in an animal reservoir for long periods of time before humans created the conditions under which they could shift into our species. So it was a bit of a matter of time before something like this happened. And, people like me who write about such things and report on them, I'm not unique. It's not like I had special knowledge. There's an entire global epidemiological community out there that has been warning about this for decades and decades. I'm sitting here in my living room looking up at a bookshelf, and there's one entire shelf of people who have written books about the coming plague, you know, pandemics mm-hmm. on the horizon. So we've been waiting, but we haven't been ready. And even though we know, obviously knew what we would need to do, we failed to do it. And this life that we're living right now is the result.
Let's bring it back to, I'm going to play a clip from produced by local-based organization AWARE in Whistler, where you talk about basic etiquette around invasive species. And your most recent book, Aliens Among Us, you dive deep into the growing problems of invasive plants, animals, and microbes. So let's just have a listen.
One of the greatest threats to biodiversity is invasive species, plants and animals that outcompete the native species and often get out of control. Unfortunately, we humans are the ones responsible for spreading them around, kind of like this burdock here.
That's right, and you can help stop the spread of invasive species by making sure you're not moving plants and animals around that might stick to clothing, footwear, or other gear. You gotta clean that stuff off before you move to any new location.
And it's not just about trails. We're trying to safeguard streams and lakes too. So remember to clean, drain, and dry all your kayaks, canoes, paddleboards, and paddles.
So remember, play, clean, go. We don't want to end up having to do this.
So you've lived in Whistler for over two decades, and in the summers, you're often in the field pulling invasive burdock plants from the forest and trails. Why do you think it's important to also do the dirty work from time to time?
Well, primarily because we're responsible for it. You know, there's a lot of plants out there, burdock would probably be one of them, that are so pervasive in some places that you might just throw your hands up in despair and say, these things have been here a long time. It's kind of a naturalized species. It's everywhere. Like, there's no point pulling it up. You're not going to get anywhere. But if you do that, if you have that attitude, then you're not going to be having your eye out for new things that might be coming into the environment as well. So I think if you feel like putting in an effort, you know, to clean an area up or help restore an ecosystem, then it's worth doing, even if it feels like you're in a huge uphill battle or it's kind of a Sisyphean task. Claire Greenberg, who is the executive director of the Sea to Sky Invasive Species Council, who I work with quite a bit and was in my book because I spent quite a bit of time with her crews in the field, said something to me once about that that I think was very pertinent, which was, well, you can't just do nothing. So if you do something, if you do anything, it's a positive. Doing nothing is just complicity to catastrophe, in my mind.
Mm-hmm. And my sense is that you never tire of doing something, but you definitely never tire of observing nature in its most simplest and humble forms. You've written that, you know, you can come across lichen and observe its complex geometrical patterns, what you call a competition of light, space, and moisture as the lichen breaks down the rock molecule by molecule. And that, you know, at the end of the winter, you might be fascinated when the snow melts and you see what you call an entire hidden civilization under a ski run. Why is it important, Leslie Anthony, to observe these small details in nature? And what hidden universes do they contain for us if we just take the time to stop and look?
I was actually fascinated listening to that. I was nodding my head going, yeah, that's right. And you brought me back to it.
Yeah.
So thank you. Yeah, I mean, you know, that was probably a moment where I had been really taken by something I had observed when I was out there and put some thought into it and like wrote a mini essay or a column around it. And to your question of why is it important to observe these things? Was that your question?
When you're out in nature, the sense I get from someone like you and from what you write about is that we can make these connections if we just pause, we just stop, we look at, you know, the little honeybee on the sunflower, anything that we see around us.
Thinking you were asking me why it's important, whereas that's actually the answer. Why do we need to stop and why do we need to look and why should we observe? And it's because it's important. It's important for us to make those connections. It's important for us to understand the continuity of all life and all nature, you know, even the inanimate and the animate. And a lichen is a perfect example of where those two worlds intersect, right? Because the lichen is a living organism, but it's also a fascinating living organism in that it's a symbiotic association of both algae and fungi, and sometimes even a few blue-green algae, but we won't get in the weeds there. And that's a fundamental aspect of life that we don't hear about much, which is it's not all nature red in tooth and claw with fierce competition of one thing trying to overcome another. There's a lot of cooperation in nature, and a lot of the big evolutionary watersheds in the history of the earth have occurred because of these sort of mutualisms and symbioses. But here we have a perfectly emblematic one of fungi and algae working together to break down rock, you know, to pull molecules out of the rock, out of this crystalline formation, and turn them into something that's usable as food energy, to turn them in the waste products of metabolizing that food energy become soil. And, you know, that whole process of building life on Earth from the ground up starts in that moment. And it's kind of a point of fascination, but it's also important that people know that, you know, that they don't just walk by a rock and see a little smudge on it and go, oh yeah, that's a lichen, but that they know, well, what is a lichen and what does it do? Why is it here? Why is the entire world covered in lichen if you actually took everything else on Earth away and left the lichens, you would still be able to see the outline of all of the continents from space. If everything else was removed, you would still see the Earth because of the amount of lichen that's here. No one knows that, but it's true.
Now, as a child, you spent countless hours outside exploring, and what you describe in your first book, Snake Bit, as a backyard to a biology's elementary school. And then the Don River, which was close to where you grew up, was no Amazon, as you say, but its muddy waters that bisected suburban North Toronto was your jungle. How did these childhood experiences still influence the person that you are today?
Well, this is an interesting point because, you know, I was lucky again. My family moved to a new suburb in the north part of Toronto when I was quite young, and we were literally right on the edge of the city. And so I had literally could walk across the street and be in a ravine or a forest and have access to this kind of nature. And I did, you know, it was like kind of the way I learned to entertain myself, I suppose, in some measure. And when I was writing that book, I was reading other books as well, various scientists' biographies, and I was struck by how many of them had had similar experiences who said, oh, yeah, you know, like, I had this lot behind my house that I used to spend hours in looking at this bug or this lizard. And another guy was like, oh yeah, my parents would drop me off at this spot to wait for a school bus. And while in the hour that I was waiting for the school bus, I would just explore into this forest to turn over rocks and logs and see how many creatures I could find. And I think when you're in your formative years and you discover a world, a universe out there that hasn't been articulated to you yet, you fixate on it, it becomes your truth. It becomes your bedrock in a way.
It's with you wherever you go, I imagine.
Forever. And in fact, it was so important to my being that even when I strayed away from my affinity to that part of myself through my teen years and young adulthood to a certain extent, I eventually came to realize that it was informing what I was doing anyway, even if I was doing something completely different, like being a ski writer or an outdoor adventure writer or something. It was that connection to nature that had sort of started the ball rolling in all of those ways as well. And it was the process of actually coming back to discovering my nerdy little nature boy self that caused me to write that book in the first place. So it was a very good way to explore that very question of, well, you know, where did I come from? Literally, how did I get to where I am now? What were the things that inspired me and created the contingencies on which the rest of my life unfolded? And hanging out in the Don River, the disgustingly polluted Don River, which of course we weren't fully aware of at the time, was basically that watershed.
You've had many influences in your life. One of them is Charles Elton, who you state is an understated British ecologist, whose 1957 book, The Ecology of Invasions by Animals and Plants, is considered the de facto precursor to today's discipline of invasion biology and science. And so I thought we'd listen to a production by the University of Oxford titled Laboratory or The Laboratory with Leaves, where Charles Elton is described as the father of ecology, who paved the way for the research that is now done in Oxford University's outdoor laboratory with them woods.
Great.
One of the nice things about the diaries is that it's enthusiastic, it's personal. There are one or two places where he throws in a little bit of poetry or totally silly things, you know, saw a newt. Saw the newt again today. It was in exactly the same place it was yesterday. And there are things like that which just sort of bring them to light.
Charles Alton was one of the early pioneers for recognising the value of progression of animal life and the communities within ecosystems.
When Whiteham Wood was donated to the university in 1942, he set it up over a period of about 30 years as a world-class research centre. People came from all over the world to collaborate with him and to explore Whiteham Wood. Alton was very much a man of his time, in that he was a very quiet, shy man. He hated having his photograph taken, for example. That's why so few survived. And I attended his lectures. Very boring lecturer he was. But his books were extremely interesting. And he was happiest with other scientists and out in the woods.
He kept a diary throughout his life. And it certainly continued after he'd retired.
So there's a period of about 5 or 6 years in the mid-70s where he took up the gauntlet again and went round all the old logs and made notes. At that point, Alton would have been well into his mid-70s, possibly later, and his wife accompanied him on some of those later trips.
And there's many, many occasions in which he and his son would go out at 4 in the morning before the boy went to school, and they would make long trips out to Whiteham to listen to birds and observe them before school or work began in the mornings. I grew up at a time when if girls were allowed to study physics and chemistry and biology like the boys did, this was regarded as a very, very great honour. And we felt we owed society a debt to continue working as for as long as we possibly could. And an email came round asking for volunteers to transcribe Elton's field notes. So I thought, well, I can do that, why not?
In terms of the notes for Whiteham, there are about 400 different entries spread over about 20-odd years. There are bird records, butterfly records, fungal records, plant records. And that is interesting because, on the one hand, most people think of him as a zoologist, but he was concerned to look at the interactions between different species and to try and look at the whole system.
It's really important that we transcribe Alton's notes and diaries, primarily because it makes it available to the masses. People can access it online and then use it for their research information.
One of the things that we were able to do was that there was a rare plant, yellow bird's nest, which hadn't been seen since 1958 in the woods. By chance, when I was reading through, I thought, oh, Alton saw it at Brogdon's Belt, which is quite a narrowly defined piece of the woodland. So we were able to go there at the right time of year, and hey presto, there was the plant. It's been sitting there for the last 30 years, just nobody had looked at the right time of year to find it. So it was rather nice, sort of, you know, rediscovery, as it were. And Charles Alton was such an important player in the discussions that were going on at that time. His diaries filled in this missing link in our study of the history of the woods.
You are listening to The Blue Hour on UBC CITR 101.9 FM and on CITR.ca. I am your host, Farha Guerrero. Tonight I have the pleasure of speaking with Leslie Anthony. Leslie, what profound influences did Charles Alton have on you personally?
Well, he basically inspired me to write The Aliens Among Us, how invasive species are transforming the planet and ourselves. Not that he kicked off my interest in invasive species, but that I came across him just as my exposure to them reached a sort of critical mass. And it was in a very unassuming and unexpected way, in that, as I mentioned before, I'd sort of gotten away from my biological roots professionally for about 15 years or so, when I was very much more of a ski and outdoor magazine editor and pretty invested in that world. And, you know, I'd still write the occasional environment or science-related article in various magazines. But largely I was a travel writer, and I went to a lot of places, different countries around the world, and literally every story that I was writing, every person I met who was like the main person or character in the story seemed to have an invasive species story to tell me as well. So I was kind of collecting them in my mind, you know, sort of in the back of your head, the way you'd be like, oh yeah, you know, I was in Australia and some guy told me about something like this too. And now here I am in Iceland and someone is explaining a similar phenomena that they're equally worried about. Anyway, this had all reached a bit of a critical mass. And I had just been at a conference, I think, in New Orleans, where I was sitting in on some sessions, and one of the papers that was presented was about invasive Burmese pythons in the Florida Everglades. And this was just completely revelatory and crazy stuff. I mean, giant snakes, you know, from Asia, thousands of them in in a national park in America. And I really had started to wonder about how far this invasive species thing was going to go. And I was down in the Reuse-It Center in Whistler, you know, the used books and things that they have there. And I came across this tattered old volume by Charles Elton, The Ecology of Invasions by Animals and Plants. And I looked at it and I was like, oh my God, this was written in 1957. It can't possibly be, you know, any good or interesting, but I bought it anyway, came home and discovered, well, literally that was the last thing that it was the first and last comprehensive book that anyone had written about this phenomena. So, you know, it was the rabbit hole in I went, so to speak.
I'd like to talk about some initiatives here locally in the Sea to Sky area that you've been a big part of, and many other scientists, on working to get the Sea to Sky Fire and Ice Geopark, as it's called, into a UNESCO heritage site. Can you tell us a little bit about that and your efforts to, and also the story around this idea of fire and ice in the region?
Okay, well, I'll try and do it justice because I'm not precisely a geologist, but certainly a student of earth sciences. Yeah, this is a really fun project. It's a corridor-wide initiative that will basically encompass Squamish, Whistler, Pemberton, and beyond eventually. And the idea of a geopark is sort of something that it's started, 20, 30 years ago in Europe and Asia, and there were these just areas of significant geology that had inherent touristic values, but also cultural values to the people who lived in them, in that the land informed what they were doing, and, the sort of terra firma point of origin, home turf kind of thing, where the physiography of the land itself is of perhaps global interest for one reason or another, but it also is of real importance to the people who live there. It might inform the type of weaving they do or the colors that they use and how they make their livings and all these kinds of things. And geoparks basically seek to unite all of this connectivity together under a touristic umbrella. And UNESCO was kind of in the background, sort of looking at this, and they had a memorandum of understanding with these geopark networks in Europe and Asia. And then in 2014, they said, okay, we'll take you on board. This will be UNESCO Global Geoparks will be a third stream next to UNESCO World Biosphere Reserves and UNESCO World Heritage Sites. They all inform the sustainable use of the land and the recognition of it and, you know, responsibility for its care. So how I got involved was I wrote about North America's first geopark, which was in St. John, New Brunswick. I had the great fortune to travel out there and attend a geopark conference that was being held there, see the geopark, understand what it was all about. While I was there, another group of people from British Columbia had a geopark project that they'd been working on recognized at that meeting by UNESCO. So all of a sudden, Canada had two geoparks that were part of this global network and the only ones in North America. And I got to thinking that we had a really interesting geological story here in the Sea to Sky Corridor, which is basically the most geologically active area in all of Canada. We have active or quasi-active volcanoes in Mount Meager up in the Pemberton Meadows, significant geohazards associated with that. We've got earthquakes in this region. We've got potential tsunamis. So there's a geohazard piece to all of this. But we've also got this fantastic Coast Mountain Range, on top of which sits the Garibaldi Volcanic Belt, and on top of which a continental glaciation happened. And while that glaciation was happening, you know, between 150,000 and 12,000 years ago, back and forth, the glaciers swept through this area. Many times there were volcanic eruptions underneath this ice sheet, and the rock formations that were created by volcanoes erupting against the ice and having the lava cool in these ice spaces are globally unique. And we have them all up and down the Sea to Sky Corridor. Probably the most famous one that everyone knows about is the Black Tusk, which you can see whether you're coming up from Squamish or heading down from Whistler. It's a significant First Nations mythological site. There's a big story about it being a landing place of the Thunderbirds. And it was literally created by a volcanic vent erupting beneath a 2 kilometer thick ice sheet. So we have a lot of geosites in the corridor, like the Black Tusk. We have, you know, waterfalls, lakes, and other things that fit into the puzzle, and we use them. We're recreating on them. They're defining our lives. They're why we're here. These things are very much a part of everyone's life in the corridor. And so it's kind of the perfect geopark story. And the RMOW commissioned a feasibility study, and they got involved, and we raised some funds, and we've been working on this geopark idea, very slowly moving the ball to getting it going. And then once we get it going, which will be this summer, then we'll make the official UNESCO geopark application. So it's a long, slow process, but kind of a rewarding one. Gets to involve a lot of field work, going out and looking for new geosites and different things that are happening, hanging out with geologists, biologists, First Nations folks. Yeah, it's kind of a great collaboration, really.
You are an extraordinary person in that you've got so many things that you know, with invasive species, you've got your life as a ski rider. adventure travel writer. You're working on this initiative. I know that you are involved heavily with other organizations locally in Whistler. And so it's fascinating to hear you talk. But I think from my senses that there's always this interconnectedness in everything that you do.
Yes.
And so when you were talking about the geopark, you said that this is land that we are, you know, recreational skiing on, we are out hiking in. And so we all are connected. Anybody that comes here, even from afar, is connected to these places, which is a segue to my next question. You have spent your life skiing, and this is in the most literal sense of the word.
Well, thank you for not saying that I have misspent my life skiing.
No. You have skied in more places around the world than most of us have ever traveled to. And skiing is, I think it's more than a passion for you. I gather it's almost a way of life, perhaps a philosophical journey of some sort. What does it mean to you to be a skier?
Oh, well, you know, Farah, it means so much that it's a hard question to answer. Maybe it's an easy question to answer as well. And it's something that I think it evolves. You know, every year skiing means more to me than it did the year before. And or maybe it means something different to me, or I have a new realization about what is this thing in my life that I can't stop doing or disconnect from, or that just seems to be a thread that pulled tight through all of this. And you know, as you can imagine, in my ski writing, which has included hundreds and hundreds of magazine features and columns and essays and a book, two books, I've had to address this question of, well, why ski? You know, what does skiing mean? And, you know, it's meaningless in one sense and incredibly meaningful in another. And I think everyone takes different bits and pieces away from the experience. But for me, if I had to like pick three things, let's say, that are important to me about skiing, I would say movement is one thing. There's something about moving through an environment. You know, it's hard to pay attention when you're in a car as much as you'd like to moving through an environment, because you're driving and you need to pay attention to driving. But when you're skiing, yeah, your body kind of is paying attention a lot of the time, and you are smelling and hearing and experiencing things, you know, undulations in the terrain, gravity, hazards. You can smell the trees, you know, the peculiar smell that trees get in the spring when you're out in a snowy environment. You see tracks in the snow. And another thing, number two, would be that it's self-directed. You're doing it by yourself in a way, even if you're with a group of people. I mean, you can be with a group of people. You can do it, you know, conjointly. But it's also a very solo enterprise. And I used to really just enjoy the idea of going skiing by myself, whether it was cross country, back in the forests in Ontario, or going touring in Banff, or around here, I often go out by myself to ski. Maybe not so much in the last few years. I ski a lot with my partner, Asta, but, you know, for my first 10 or 15 years here, I was a real solo artist. And I didn't even know that I was consciously kind of veering towards skiing by myself, because it was a way for me to work things out, to think through things. Something to do again with movement and being by yourself. I get similar things from running. ideas come to you, you're able to process them. As soon as you stop skiing, it's like they kind of go back in the drawer. Then you go out skiing again, and out they come again. Same way with running. You know, I have those same experiences. The third thing, number three, and maybe it should probably be the number one on the list if we're going to order them, is that it's fun. It's just fun. It's damn fun. And people like fun things. We, as humans, are driven to pleasure, you know? And all you got to do is see a bunch of otters sliding into a creek somewhere, and you realize that that's not just unique to us, that this fun, pleasure-seeking instinct is there, you know, in evolutionary history. So, you know, damn it, we're not going to waste that. That's our birthright.
Yeah. I'm going to play a clip from the late Andreas Franzen. It's from Outside TV, and it's just a little clip from the documentary Tempting Fear Inside the Mind of Andreas Franzen. Have a listen.
So here I am again, in this game with the mountains. Could you get the thrill of your life and feel truly alive if you knew they were perfectly safe? Would it be a game worth playing at all if the outcome was certain? Sane is only based on what's widely seen as normal. Only by defying society's expectations can you find the true uncertainty that defines adventure. Exposing yourself to nature's blows. We just hope we're not unlucky that day. It's a simple fact.
You've met Andreas Franzen. If I recall, he had a book idea. He was a writer like you in many ways. I know you had some good memories with him.
Yeah, I did. And I had worked on that film, Tempting Fear, with him and Mike Douglas, who was the director. And I think that was the first time that I had read a lot of Andreas's writing. He had a blog online, and some of that material ended up being worked into the narrative. He was a very cerebral fellow, but he was also, he was looking into the abyss, I think. He was trying to see into the abyss without falling into it. He was someone who you would very much, or the general public would very much say, was doing things that were on the edge that most people wouldn't understand the degree of risk that he, or they would understand what the degree of risk was, so they wouldn't understand why he was taking it. And I think Andreas spent a lot of time trying to rationalize to himself or understand why he was taking these risks as well. And, but he was also a very interested person. He was interested in everything. He was someone that you could talk to about any topic. He would love to, you know, do a deep dive into it. You often had to disentangle yourself from the chats you were having because reality was coming in from the outside. You know, like he was someone who could take your entire focus away from everything else. And I did spend a fair amount of time with him talking, chatting about various things. And he had in one of those chats talked to me about a book that he had wanted to do or that he was getting ready to think about doing and wanted some help formulating an outline and it was going to be about mountain craft. It was going to be, it almost sounded like a sort of dull technical manual kind of thing, except that he wanted to not do the dull technical manual of mountain craft that there was dozens of out there, but to do a more cerebral philosophical manual of mountain craft a la Andreas Fronson. And I wish he had have lived to fulfill that vision he had. And I wish I had been able to work on it with him because I think it was a great idea. It would have been a really difficult child to bring to life because the whole idea of weighing risk and reward, and as you heard on that clip that you played, is kind of it's a tough sell. So to create a book about moving in the mountains and being safe and using skills and need all of that material in there as well would have been difficult but interesting. And yeah, the last time I saw him, we were in Iceland together, and that was April. And then I think it was later that summer that he and J.P. O'Claire died in an avalanche in Chile. It was a very dark day for a lot of us, I think, and one that threw me for quite a loop. There's quite a few people I've known over the years who've died in skiing and climbing accidents, and it never gets any easier to deal with them, but somehow I feel I'd managed to up until that point. But when JP and Andreas died at the same time, in the same accident, both of them very good friends of mine in completely different ways and at very different times, I definitely experienced a lot of disconnectedness and despair, and I didn't want to write about skiing, you know, at all, basically. I thought I was done. I didn't know it at the time, but I withdrew very far from the whole milieu and only came back around to it many months later when I felt I really needed to eulogize those two amazing human beings in some way. And forcing myself to do that kind of forced me back over the threshold and back into ski riding. But it's, I got to say, I don't think it's ever been the same for me since. I'm definitely much more of an observer now, one foot in, one foot out, than I was before.
It's been a wonderful pleasure to be speaking with you today. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Leslie Anthony here on the Blue Hour on CITR.ca on 101.9 FM in Vancouver. We're going to end the show today with listening to another tune, a favorite song of yours titled Those to Come by The Shins. Do you want to set it up?
Sure. Shins are another band that kind of were introduced to me by a friend and were a bit of a revelation. I very much enjoy the lyrics of James Mercer, who's the songwriter, lead guitarist, and singer. He seems to have a real sensibility about the natural world. He's often referring to things that I think, you know, only biologists would know, like what he's talking about. And there's a few things in this song that are kind of in that vein as well. And well, thank you very much for having me, Farha. I thoroughly enjoyed chatting with you.
Thank you so much, Leslie. So here we are, Those to Come by The Shins.
Just